I had to take the kids on tour with me, which wasn't fun for anyone. So the following year, I really needed those vacations. One night in the quick change area before a show, my team came in and I flagged it for them. "Hey," I said, "I just wanted to give you a heads up. I really need those vacations this year." Tradition is so important to me. Me and my kids' favorite thing to do was to go to Maui and get a boat and just head out into the ocean. It's for my mental health, honestly. "If there's a large amount of money," my team said, "we'll go and do like 2 tour shows and then you can come back and have the whole summer off." "Great," I said. "We're on the same page." A few months went by. Vegas was finally coming to an end in December 2017. I was so relieved. I'd done hundreds of shows. As I was in my dressing room changing in between acts, someone from my team said, "Hey, yeah, so you are going on tour this year after Vegas ends. It can't just end in Vegas. We have to end it on tour this summer." "That wasn't the deal," I said. "I told you, I'm taking the kids to Maui." The conversation escalated quickly, as it usually did when I tried to negotiate. Finally, my team member said, "If you don't go on tour, you will end up in court because you have a contract." I realized they were threatening me, and they knew how triggering being in court was for me. Afterward, I calmed down. I started thinking that if it was just a few weeks, it wouldn't be that bad. Then I could come back and still have something of a summer. We could just go to Maui a little later. This turned out to be overly optimistic. The tour was hell. I know the dancers felt it too. We were more locked down than ever by the terms my father set. To even leave the room, we had to give the security team 2 hours' notice. To add insult to injury, I was still creatively stifled, still doing the same old thing. They still weren't giving me the freedom to redo my songs and change up the show. We could have changed the show and made something good, something new, that would have felt fresh to the audience and to me and the dancers. That's the only concession I asked for, and again, as always, they said no. Because if I actually took control of my show, it could awaken people to the fact that I might not need my dad as my conservator. I feel like he secretly liked me feeling less than. It gave him power. When I finally got home, I cried when I saw my dogs. That's how much I'd missed them. I started to plan a trip to take with the boys to make up for how much time we'd lost. My team said, "We'll give you 3 weeks off, and then we have to start rehearsing for a new Vegas show." 3 weeks, I said, I was supposed to have all summer. I'd hated the tour. This felt like being told that the weekend would never come. Chapter 40. I could hear the screams already. Hundreds of people had gathered outside. It was an October day in 2018, and there was a huge crowd outside the New Park MGM Hotel in Las Vegas. Superfans were dressed in matching clothes and waving flags emblazoned with the letter B. Dancers on stage were wearing t-shirts that said Britney. Announcers were live streaming, hyping up their followers. Laser lights were flashing. A giant screen was showing scenes from my videos. Dance music blasted. A parade went by with marchers loudly singing lyrics like, "My loneliness is killing me." The lights went down. Mario Lopez, who was there to host the event, said into the mic, "We are here to welcome the new Queen of Vegas." Dramatic music started, a riff from Toxic. Crazy lights flashed on the Park MGM so it looked like the building was pulsing. Cue a medley of other songs and projections of a rocket ship, a helicopter, a circus big top, and a snake in the Garden of Eden. Fire blasted up from fire pits around the stage. I rose from the floor on a hydraulic lift, waving and smiling in a tight little black dress with star cutouts and tassels, my hair super long and blonde. "Ladies and gentlemen," Mario Lopez continued, "Britney Spears." I walked down the stairs in my high heels to work, bitch, and signed a few autographs for fans. But then I did something unexpected. I walked past the cameras. I kept walking until I got into an SUV and left. I said nothing. I did not perform. If you were watching, you were probably wondering, What just happened? What you didn't see was that my father and his team were trying to force me to announce the show. I'd said I didn't want to announce it because, as I'd been saying for months, I didn't want to do it. When I'd sung the song Overprotected so many years earlier, I had no idea what overprotection was. I'd learn soon, because once I made it clear that I wasn't going to keep doing Vegas, my family made me disappear. Chapter 41. As the holidays approached, I was feeling pretty good. Aside from my fear that my father was plotting something, I felt strong and inspired by the women I'd met in AA. In addition to being brilliant, they had so much common sense, and I'd learned a lot from them about how to be an adult woman navigating the world with honesty and bravery. For my birthday, Hisam took me somewhere special. I started making holiday plans, but my father insisted that he would be taking the boys for Christmas. If I wanted to see them, I'd have to see my father too. When I pushed back, my father said, "The boys don't want to be with you this year. They're coming home to Louisiana with me and your mom, and that's that." "This is news to me," I said. "But if they'd really rather be in Louisiana that week, I guess that's okay." The Vegas show hadn't been canceled yet. I was hiring new dancers and going over the routines. At rehearsal one day, I'd been working with all the dancers, both new and old, when one of the dancers who'd been with the show the past 4 years did a move for us all. I winced when I saw it. It looked really challenging. "I don't want to do that one," I said. "It's too hard." It didn't seem like a big deal to me, but suddenly my team and the directors disappeared into a room and shut the door. I got the feeling that I had done something horribly wrong. But I didn't understand how not wanting to do one dance move in a routine could qualify as that. I mean, I was almost 5 years older than I'd been when the first residency started. My body had changed, too. What difference did it make if we changed it up? We'd all been having fun, from what I could tell. I have social anxiety, so if there's anything to feel uncomfortable about, I usually feel it first. But that day, all seemed well. I was laughing and talking to the dancers. Some of the new ones could do gainers, meaning a standing back tuck going forward. They were amazing. I asked if I could learn it, and one of them offered to spot me on it. All of which is to say, we were playing and communicating. Nothing was going wrong. But the way my team had behaved made me worried something was up. A day later in therapy, my doctor confronted me. "We found energy supplements in your purse," he said. The energy supplements gave me a sense of confidence and energy, and you didn't need a prescription for them. He knew that I'd been taking them during my shows in Vegas, but now he made a big deal out of it. "We feel like you're doing way worse things behind our backs," he said. "And we don't feel like you're doing well in rehearsals. You're giving everyone a hard time." "Is this a joke?" I said. Instantly, I was furious. I had tried so hard. My work ethic was strong. "We're going to be sending you to a facility," the therapist said. "And before you go to this place, over Christmas break, we're going to have a woman come run psychological tests on you." A flashy doctor, who I'd seen on TV and instinctively hated, came to my house against my will, sat me down, and tested my cognitive abilities for hours. My father told me that this doctor had concluded that I'd bombed the tests. "She said you failed. Now you have to go to the mental health facility. There's something severely wrong with you. But don't worry. We found you a small rehab program in Beverly Hills. It will only cost you $60,000 a month." As I gathered my stuff, crying, I asked how long I should pack for, how long they'd make me stay there. But I was told there was no way to know. Maybe a month, maybe 2 months. Maybe 3 months. It all depends on how well you do and how well you demonstrate your capabilities. The program was supposedly a luxury rehab that had created a special program for me, so I'd be alone and wouldn't have to interact with other people. "What if I don't go?" I asked. My father said that if I didn't go, then I'd have to go to court and I'd be embarrassed. He said, We will make you look like a fucking idiot, and trust me, you will not win. It's better me telling you to go versus a judge in court telling you. I felt like it was a form of blackmail and I was being gaslit. I honestly felt they were trying to kill me. I had never stood up to my dad in all those years. I never said no to anyone. My no in that room that day really pissed my dad off. They forced me to go. They had my back against a wall and I had no choice. If you don't do this, this is what's going to happen to you, so we suggest you go and get it over with. Only that didn't happen, getting it over with, that is. Because once I got there, I couldn't leave, even though I kept begging to. They kept me locked up against my will for months. Chapter 42. The doctors took me away from my kids and my dogs and my house. I couldn't go outside. I couldn't drive a car. I had to give blood weekly. I couldn't take a bath in private. I couldn't shut the door to my room. I was watched even when I was changing. I had to go to sleep at 9 p.m. They supervised me watching TV from 8 to 9 o'clock in bed. I had to be up every morning at 8. I had endless meetings every day. For several hours a day, I sat in a chair receiving mandatory therapy. I spent the time in between meetings staring out the window, watching cars pull up and drive away. So many cars bringing so many therapists and security guards, doctors and nurses. What I think did the most damage to me was watching all those people coming and going while I was prevented from leaving. I was told that everything that was happening was for my own good. But I felt abandoned in that place. And while everyone kept saying they were there to help me, I never could understand what my family wanted from me. I did everything I was supposed to do. My kids would come for an hour on the weekends. But if I didn't do what I was supposed to do during the week, I wouldn't be allowed to see them. One of the only people who called me was Cade. I've always felt safe and yet also a sense of danger with Cade. The most entertaining call I had the whole time was his FaceTiming me from a hospital in Texas to tell me about how he'd gotten bitten by a scorpion in his bed. In his bed. His leg blew up to the size of a basketball, no joke. "Are you serious right now?" I said, looking at his swollen leg on my phone. It was unbelievably bad. Thinking about Cade's poor leg gave me one of the only true distractions from what I was dealing with. And I'll always be grateful to him and that Texas scorpion. The therapists questioned me for hours and what seemed like every day, 7 days a week. For years, I'd been on Prozac. But in the hospital, they took me abruptly off it and put me on lithium, a dangerous drug that I did not want or need and that makes you extremely slow and lethargic. I felt my concept of time morph and I grew disoriented. On lithium, I didn't know where I was or even who I was sometimes. My brain wasn't working the way it used to. It wasn't lost on me that lithium was the drug my grandmother Jean, who later committed suicide, had been put on in Mandeville. Meanwhile, my security team that I'd been with for so long acted like I was a criminal. When it was time for blood draws, the tech drawing my blood would be flanked by the nurse, a security guard, and my assistant. Was I a cannibal? Was I a bank robber? Was I a wild animal? Why was I treated as though I were about to burn the place down and murder them all? They checked my blood pressure 3 times a day like I was an 80-year-old woman, and they'd take their time, make me sit down, get the cuff, slowly attach it, slowly pump it up, 3 times a day. To feel sane, I needed to move around. Movement was my life as a dancer. I thrived on it. I needed it and craved it, but they kept me in that chair for ages. I began to feel like I was being ritually tortured. I felt anxious in my feet and in my heart and in my brain. I could never burn off that energy. You know how when your body is moving, you're reminded that you're alive? That's all I wanted. And I couldn't move, which meant I began to wonder if I might actually already be half dead. I felt ruined. My ass grew bigger from sitting in a chair for hours a day, so much so that none of my shorts fit anymore. I became estranged from my own body. I had terrible nightmares where I was running through a forest, dreams that felt so real. Please wake up, please wake up, please wake up. I don't want it to be real. This is just a dream, I would think. If the idea of my being in that place was to heal, that was not the effect. I began to imagine myself as a bird without wings. You know how, when you're a child, sometimes you run around with your arms outstretched and with the wind moving over your arms, and for a second you feel like you're flying? That was what I wanted to feel. Instead, every day it felt like I was sinking into the earth. I did the program by myself for 2 months in Beverly Hills. It was hell, like being in my very own horror movie. I watch scary movies. I've seen The Conjuring. I'm not scared of anything after those months at that treatment center. Seriously, I'm not scared of anything now. I'm probably the least fearful woman alive at this point, but it doesn't make me feel strong. It makes me sad. I shouldn't be this strong. Those months made me too tough. I miss my days of being what in Kentwood we used to call a sass-ass. That time in the hospital took away my sassiness. In so many ways, it broke my spirit. After 2 months in one building, I was moved to another run by the same people, and at this one I wasn't alone. Even though I used to prefer being by myself, after 2 months in what felt like solitary confinement and on lithium, it was honestly so much better to be around other patients. We were together all day. At night, each of us was left alone in an individual room. The doors made a pow sound as they shut. My first week, one of the other patients came to my room and said, "Why are you screaming so loud?" "Huh, I'm not screaming," I said. "We all hear you. You're screaming so loud." I looked around my room. "I don't even have music playing," I said. I later learned that she sometimes heard things other people didn't hear, but that freaked me out. A very pretty girl arrived and became instantly popular. It felt like high school, where she was the cheerleader and I was the demoralized nerd. She skipped all of the meetings. Even though a lot of the people there were wild as hell, I liked most of them. One girl smoked thin cigarettes I'd never seen before. She was adorable, and so were her cigarettes. I noticed that her dad would come see her on the weekends. My family, meanwhile, had thrown me into that place and gone about their lives. "I know you see my cigarettes," the adorable girl said to me one day. "I bet you want to try one, don't you?" I thought she'd never ask. "Yeah," I said. And so I smoked my first Capri cigarette with her and some other girls. A couple of people there had eating disorders, and they were distressingly skinny. I didn't eat that much myself. Between how little I was eating and how much blood I was giving for all the tests, I was amazed that I wasn't wasting away. God must have been with me through that period of time. 3 months into my confinement, I started to believe that my little heart, whatever made me Brittany, was no longer inside my body anymore. Something bigger must have been carrying me through, because it was too much for me to bear alone. I look at the fact that I survived and I think, that wasn't me. That was God. Chapter 43. The hardest part was that I believed that, in front of the doctors or visitors, I had to pretend the whole time I was okay. If I became flustered, it was taken as evidence that I wasn't improving. If I got upset and asserted myself, I was out of control and crazy. It reminded me of what I'd always heard about the way they'd test to see if someone was a witch in the olden days. They'd throw the woman into a pond. If she floated, she was a witch and would be killed. If she sank, she was innocent and, oh well, she was dead either way, but I guess they figured it was still good to know what kind of woman she'd been. After a couple of months, I called my father to beg him to let me go home. He said, "I'm sorry, the judge is going to have to figure out what she's going to do with you. It's up to the doctors right now. I can't help you at all. I'm giving you to the doctors and I can't help you." The strange part is, before they put me in that place, my dad had sent me a pearl necklace and a beautiful handwritten card for Christmas. I asked myself, why is he doing this? Who is he? What hurt me most was that for years he'd been saying in front of the cameras, whether it was when I did the Work Bitch video or when the conservatorship first started and we did the circus tour, that he was all about me and the boys. That's my baby girl, he'd say right into the camera. I love her so much. I was stuck in a trailer with Lou's weird-ass lackey Robin, who I'd grown to hate, while he talked about what a great daddy was to anyone who would listen. But now, when I was refusing to do the New Vegas residency, when I was pushing back on tours, was I still his beloved baby girl? Apparently not. A lawyer would later say, your dad could have totally put a stop to all that. He could have told the doctors, no, this is too much, let's let my daughter go home. But he didn't. I called my mom to ask her why everyone was acting like I was so dangerous. Well, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, she would say. I also texted my sister when I was in that place and asked her to get me out. Stop fighting it, she texted back. There's nothing you can do about it, so stop fighting it. Along with the rest of them, she kept acting like I was a threat in some way. This will sound crazy, but I'll say it again because it's the truth. I thought they were going to try to kill me. I didn't understand how Jamie Lynn and our father had developed such a good relationship. She knew I was reaching out to her for help and that he was dogging me. I felt like she should have taken my side. One of my girlfriends who helped me change clothes every night in the underground changing room during my Vegas run later said, Brittany, I had 3 or 4 nightmares when you were at that center. I would wake up in the middle of the night. I had dreams that you killed yourself in that place. And I dreamed that Robin, the lady who was your so-called nice assistant, called me and said proudly, yeah, she died in the place. My friend said she worried about me the whole time. Several weeks into my stay, I was struggling to stay hopeful when one of the nurses, the only one who was real as hell, called me over to her computer. Look at this, she said. I peered at her computer and tried to make sense of what I was seeing. It was women on a talk show talking about me and the conservatorship. One was wearing a #FreeBrittany t-shirt. The nurse showed me clips of other things, too. Fans saying they were trying to figure out if I was being held somewhere against my will. Talking about how much my music meant to them and how they hated to think I was suffering now. They wanted to help. And just by doing that, they did help. All the things the nurse was seeing, everyone at the hospital was seeing too. The doctor eventually noticed that people around the world were asking why I was still locked up. It was all over the news. The same way I believe that I can sense how someone's feeling in Nebraska, I think my connection to my fans helped them subconsciously know that I was in danger. We have a connection, no matter where we are in space. Even if you're on the other side of the country or the world, on some level we're bound up together. Fans of mine, even though I hadn't said anything online or in the press about being confined, they just seemed to know. Seeing them marching in the streets, chanting Free Britney, that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. I know some people laughed at it. They saw the pink t-shirts with my name on them and said, what kind of cause is this? But if they really knew what I was going through and understood the connection I have with my fans, I don't think they would have laughed. The truth is, I was being held against my will. And I did long to know that people might care whether I lived or died. What do we have except our connections to one another? And what stronger bond is there than music? Everyone who spoke out for me helped me survive that hard year, and the work they did helped me win my freedom. I don't think people knew how much the #FreeBrittany movement meant to me, especially in the beginning. Toward the end, when the court hearings were going on, seeing people advocating for me meant a whole lot. But when it first happened, that got my heart. Because I was not okay. Not at all. And the fact that my friends and my fans sensed what was happening and did all that for me, that's a debt I can never repay. If you stood up for me when I couldn't stand up for myself, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Chapter 44. When I finally returned to my home and my dogs and my kids, I was ecstatic. Guess who wanted to come visit me the first week I was back? My family. "We're so proud of you, Brittany," my dad said. "You did it. Now we all want to come and stay with you." But by this point, I could fully see through his bullshit. I knew what he was really saying was, "I can't wait to see your money. I mean, you." And so they came. My father, my mom, and my sister with her daughters Maddie and Ivy. I was a shell of myself. I was still on lithium, which made my sense of time really hazy, and I was scared. It crossed my mind that they were only visiting to finish off what they'd started a few months earlier, to kill me for real. If that sounds paranoid, consider all the things I'd been through up until this point, the ways in which they had deceived and institutionalized me. And so I played the game. If I'm nice to them, they won't ever try to kill me again, I thought. For 3.5 months, I'd had barely a hug from anybody. It makes me want to cry. How strong my little heart had to be. But my family walked into my house like nothing had happened, like I hadn't just endured an almost unbearable trauma in that place. "Oh, hey, girl, what you doing?" Jamie Lynn said, sounding chipper. She and my mother and the girls were always hanging around in my kitchen. Jamie Lynn had scheduled all these TV show meetings when she was in Los Angeles. My dad would go with her to the meetings in Hollywood, and she'd come back loud and happy. "What's up, boys?" she'd shout, walking into the kitchen and seeing my sons. She'd really found her mojo. I was happy for her. At the same time, I didn't particularly want to be around it just then. "Oh my God, I have this really great idea for me and you," she'd say after coming back from yet another meeting, as I leaned, practically comatose, against the countertop. "Get this, a sister talk show." Every time she spoke, it was a new scheme, a sitcom, a rom-com. She talked for what felt like hours at a time while I looked at the floor and listened. And the phrase echoing around my head was, "What the fuck is going on?" Once my family left my house after that terrible visit, I started to really feel what I'd been through. And I was left with nothing but a blind rage. They'd punished me. For what? For supporting them since I was a child? How had I managed not to kill myself in that place? Put myself out of my misery like you'd shoot a lame horse. I believe that almost anyone else in my situation would have. Thinking about how close I came to doing just that, I wept. Then something happened to knock me out of my stupor. That August, my father was arguing with Sean Preston, who was 13 at the time. My son went to lock himself in a bedroom to end the fight, and my dad broke down the door and shook him. Kevin filed a police report, and my father was barred from seeing the kids. I knew I had to summon one more round of strength to fight one last time. It had been such a long road of finding faith and losing it again, of being pushed down and getting back up, of chasing freedom only for it to slip right out of my grasp. If I was strong enough to survive everything I'd survived, I could take a chance and ask for just a little bit more from God. I was going to ask, with every bit of my motherfucking blood and skin, for the end of the conservatorship. Because I didn't want those people running my life anymore. I didn't even want them in my goddamn kitchen. I didn't want them to have the power to keep me from my children or from my house or from my dogs or from my car ever, ever again. If I can manifest anything, I thought, let me manifest an end to this. Chapter 45. The first step toward securing my freedom was for people to begin to understand that I was still a real person. And I knew that I could do that by sharing more of my life on social media. I started trying on new clothes and modeling them on Instagram. I found it incredibly fun. Even though some people online thought it was odd, I didn't care. When you've been sexualized your whole life, it feels good to be in complete control of the wardrobe and the camera. I tried to get back in touch with my creativity and to follow visual and music artists on Instagram. I came across a guy making trippy videos. One was just a baby pink screen with a white tiger with pink stripes walking across it. Seeing that, I felt a natural urge to create something myself, and I started playing around with a song. At the beginning of it, I added the sound of a baby laughing. I thought it was different. Hisam said, "Don't put a baby laughing in it." I listened to his advice and took it out. But a while later, another account I follow posted a video with a baby laughing, and I was jealous. I should have done that, I thought. That creepy laughing baby should have been my thing. Artists are weird, you know? There were so many people in the industry at that time thinking that I was out of my mind. At a certain point, I'd rather be crazy and able to make what I want than a good sport and doing what everyone tells me to do without being able to actually express myself. And on Instagram, I wanted to show that I existed. I also found myself laughing more, transported by comedians like Amy Schumer, Kevin Hart, Sebastian Maniscalco, and Joe Coy. I developed such respect for their wit and their cleverness, how they use language to get under people's skin and to make them laugh. That's a gift. Hearing them use their voices, being so distinctively themselves, reminded me that that was something I could do too, when I made videos on social media or even just in a caption. Humor made it possible for me to not get consumed by bitterness. I've always admired people in the entertainment industry who have a sharp wit. Laughter is the cure for everything. People might laugh because things I post are innocent or strange, or because I can get mean when I'm talking about people who've hurt me. Maybe this has been a feminist awakening. I guess what I'm saying is that the mystery of who the real me is to my advantage, because nobody knows. My kids laugh at me sometimes, and when they do it, I don't mind so much. They've always helped change my perspective on the world. Since they were little, they've always seen things differently, and they're both so creative. Sean Preston is a genius at school. He's really, really bright. Jaden has such an incredible gift with the piano, it gives me chills. Before the pandemic, they were with me for delicious dinners 2 or 3 nights a week. They were always sharing amazing things they'd made and explaining to me what they were excited about. "Mom, check out this painting I made," one of them would say. I'd tell them what I saw, and they'd say, "Yeah, but now, Mom, look at it like this." And I'd see even more on what they'd made. I love them for their depth and their character, their talent and their goodness. As we entered a new decade, everything was just starting to make sense again. Then COVID hit. For the first months of lockdown, I became even more of a homebody than I already had been. I spent days, weeks, sitting in my room, listening to self-help audiobooks, staring at the wall, or making jewelry, bored out of my mind. When I'd run through a ton of self-help audiobooks, I moved on to storytelling ones. Anything that turned up under the heading of imagination, especially any book that had a narrator with a British accent. But out in the world, the security team imposed by my father kept enforcing rules. One day I was on the beach and I took off my mask. Security ran over to scold me. I was reprimanded and grounded for weeks. Because of the way quarantines were and his work schedule, I didn't have Hisam with me. I was so lonely, I even got to missing my family. I called my mom and said, "I want to see you guys." She said, "We're shopping right now, gotta go, we'll call you later." And then they didn't. The rules of lockdown were different in Louisiana, and they were always out and about. Eventually, I gave up getting them on the phone and went to Louisiana to see them. They seemed so free there. Why did I keep talking to them? I'm not sure. Why do we ever stay in dysfunctional relationships? For one thing, I was still scared of them, and I wanted to make nice. My father still legally was me, as he never hesitated to point out, though I hope not for long. It was during this period of time with my family that I learned that while I'd been in the mental health facility, they'd thrown away a lot of what I'd stored at my mother's house. The Madame Alexander dolls I'd collected as a girl were all gone, so were 3 years' worth of my writing. I had a binder full of poetry that had real meaning for me. All gone. When I saw the empty shelves, I felt an overwhelming sadness. I thought of the pages I'd written through tears. I never wanted to publish them or anything like that, but they were important to me. And my family had thrown them in the trash, just like they'd thrown me away. Then I pulled myself together and I thought, I can get a new notebook and I can start over. I've been through a lot. The reason why I'm alive today is because I know joy. It was time to find God again. In that moment, I made peace with my family, by which I mean that I realized I never wanted to see them again, and I was at peace with that. Chapter 46. The court-appointed lawyer who had been with me for 13 years had never been much help, but during the pandemic, I started to wonder whether maybe I could use him to my advantage. With a prayer-like consistency, I began to speak with him twice a week just to meditate on my options. Was he working for me or for my father in lieu? While he talked around the issue, I'd think, you don't seem to believe in what I know. I know where I'm going with this. I'm going all the way to end it. I can tell you're not going to get this done. Finally, I hit a turning point. There was honestly no more that he could do for me. I had to take control. I had stayed quiet publicly about the whole thing, but I was praying in my head for it to end. I mean real prayer. So on the night of June 22, 2021, from my home in California, I called 911 to report my father for conservatorship abuse. The time between when I started pushing hard to end the conservatorship and when it finally ended was a rough period in limbo. I didn't know how things would turn out. Meanwhile, I couldn't say no to my dad or make my own way yet, and it felt like every day there was another documentary about me on yet another streaming service. This was what was going on when I learned that my sister would be coming out with a book. I was still under my father's control. I couldn't say anything to defend myself. I wanted to explode. Seeing the documentaries about me was rough. I understand that everyone's heart was in the right place, but I was hurt that some old friends spoke to filmmakers without consulting me first. I was shocked that people I'd trusted went on camera. I didn't understand how they could talk about me behind my back like that. If it was me, I would have called my friend to see if it was okay if I talked about her. There was so much guessing about what I must have thought or felt. Chapter 47. Miss Spears, you may feel free to address me. The voice crackled through the phone. I was in my living room. It was an ordinary summer afternoon in Los Angeles. On June 23, 2021, I was finally due to address a Los Angeles probate court on the subject of the conservatorship. And I knew the world was listening. I had been practicing this for days, but now that the moment was here, the stakes felt overwhelming. Not least because I knew, since I'd asked for this hearing to be open to the public, that millions of people would be listening to my voice as soon as I was done speaking. My voice. It was everywhere, all over the world, on the radio, on television, on the internet, but there were so many parts of me that had been suppressed. My voice had been used for me and against me so many times that I was afraid nobody would recognize it now if I spoke freely. What if they called me crazy? What if they said I was lying? What if I said the wrong thing and it all went sideways? I had written so many versions of this statement. I tried a million ways to get it right, to say what I needed to say. But now, in the moment, I was so nervous. And then, through the fear, I remembered that there were still things I could hold on to. My desire for people to understand what I'd been through. My faith that all this could change. My belief that I had a right to experience joy. My knowledge that I deserved my freedom. This sense, deeply felt and profound, that the woman in me was still strong enough to fight for what was right. I looked up at Hisam, who was seated on the couch next to me. He squeezed my hand. And so, for the first time in what felt like forever, I began to tell my story. I said to the judge, I've lied and told the whole world I'm okay and I'm happy. It's a lie. I thought that maybe if I just said that enough, maybe I might become happy because I've been in denial. But now I'm telling you the truth, okay? I'm not happy. I can't sleep. I'm so angry it's insane. And I'm depressed. I cry every day. I went on to say, I don't even drink alcohol. I should drink alcohol considering what they put my heart through. I said, I wish I could stay on the phone with you forever, because when I get off the phone with you, all of a sudden, all I hear are these no's. And then all of a sudden, I feel ganged up on, and I feel bullied, and I feel left out and alone. And I'm tired of feeling alone. I deserve to have the same rights as anybody does, by having a child, a family, any of those things, and more so. And that's all I wanted to say to you. And thank you so much for letting me speak to you today. I barely breathed. It was the first chance I'd gotten to speak publicly in so long, and a million things had come pouring out. I waited to hear how the judge would respond. I hoped I'd get some indication of where her head was at. I just want to tell you that I certainly am sensitive to everything that you said and how you're feeling, she said. I know that it took a lot of courage for you to say everything you have to say today, and I want you to know that the court does appreciate your coming on the line and sharing how you're feeling. That made me feel a sense of relief, like I'd finally been listened to after 13 years. I have always worked so hard. I put up with being held down for a long time. But when my family put me in that facility, they took it too far. I was treated like a criminal, and they made me think I deserved that. They made me forget my self-worth and my value. Of all the things they did, I will say that the worst was to make me question my faith. I never had strict ideas about religion. I just knew there was something bigger than me. Under their control, I stopped believing in God for a while. But then, when it came time to end the conservatorship, I realized one thing. You can't fuck with a woman who knows how to pray. Really pray. All I did was pray. Chapter 48. I'd been lied to for the past 13 years. The whole world knew I needed a new lawyer, and finally I realized the same thing. It was time to take back control of my own life. I reached out to my social media team and to my friend Cade for help finding one. This is when I got Matthew Rosengard on board, and he was amazing. A prominent former federal prosecutor, now with a major law firm, he had a number of famous clients like Steven Spielberg and Keanu Reeves and a lot of experience with high-profile, challenging cases. We spoke several times on the phone and then met in early July in my pool house. Once Matthew was in my corner, I felt that I was getting closer to the end. Something had to happen. It couldn't stay at a standstill. But of course, because it was the legal system, we had to do a lot of waiting and strategizing. He was appalled that I'd been denied my own lawyer for so long. He said even vicious criminals get to pick their own lawyers, and he said he hated bullying. I was glad, because I saw my father and Lou and Robin as bullies, and I wanted them out of my life. Matthew said he would go to court and file a motion to remove my dad as conservator first, and then, after that, it would be easier to try to terminate the entire conservatorship. Just a few weeks later, on July 26th, he filed to eliminate my father from that role. After a big court hearing on September 29th, my father was suspended as my conservator. It was all over the news before Matthew could even call me after court. I felt relief sweep over me. The man who had scared me as a child and ruled over me as an adult, who had done more than anyone to undermine my self-confidence, was no longer in control of my life. At that point, with my father eliminated, Matthew told me we had momentum and he petitioned for the end of the conservatorship altogether. I was at a resort in Tahiti in November when Matthew called me with the news that I was no longer under a conservatorship. He'd told me when I left for the trip that one day soon I'd be able to wake up for the first time in 13 years a free woman. Still, I couldn't believe it when he called me as soon as he came out of the court hearing and told me it was done. I was free. Even though it was his strategy that had gotten us the victory, he told me that I deserved the credit for what had happened. He said that by giving my testimony, I'd freed myself and probably also helped other people in unfair conservatorships. After having my father take credit for everything I did for so long, it meant everything to have this man tell me that I'd made the difference in my own life. And now, finally, it was my own life. Being controlled made me so angry on behalf of anyone who doesn't have the right to determine their own fate. I'm just grateful, honestly, for each day. I'm not here to be a victim, I said on Instagram after the conservatorship was terminated. I lived with victims my whole life as a child. That's why I got out of my house and worked for 20 years and worked my ass off. Hopefully, my story will make an impact and make some changes in the corrupt system. In the months since that phone call, I've been trying to rebuild my life day by day. I'm trying to learn how to take care of myself and to have some fun, too. On vacation in Cancun, I got to do something I'd loved years earlier, jet skiing. The last time I'd jet skied before that, I'd been in Miami with the boys when I went too fast because I was trying to keep up with them. Those kids are borderline dangerous on a jet ski. They go extremely fast and do jumps. Riding over the waves after them, I was hitting hard, boom, 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 and falling down, wiping out and hurting my arm. Not wanting to repeat that experience, in May 2022, I got my assistant to drive me instead. It's way better when someone drives you, I found. This time I could feel the power of the engine, I could enjoy being out on the clear blue water, and I could go exactly the speed I wanted to. That's the kind of thing I'm doing now, trying to have fun and trying to be kind to myself, to take things at my own pace. And, for the first time in a long time, allowing myself to trust again. Every day I put music on. When I walk around my house singing, I feel completely free, completely at ease, completely happy. Whether I sound perfect or not, I don't even care. Singing makes me feel confident and strong, the same way exercise does, or prayer. Remember, your tongue is your sword. Anything that gets your heart rate up is good. Music is that. Plus a connection to God. That's where my heart is. When I had full-time access to a studio in Malibu, I loved going there regularly. One day I created 6 songs. Music is at its purest for me when I'm doing it for myself. I thought I might get a studio again someday and just play around, but for some time I hadn't been thinking about recording. I changed my mind about that when I got invited to record a song with an artist I've admired my entire life, Sir Elton John. He's one of my all-time favorite performers. I'd met him at an Oscars party about a decade ago, and we got along so well. And now here he was, reaching out with the sweetest video message, asking if I would be interested in collaborating on one of his most iconic songs. Hold Me Closer would be a modernized duet version of his hit, Tiny Dancer, with bits of a couple of his other songs, too. I was so honored. Like me, Elton John has been through so much publicly. It's given him incredible compassion. What a beautiful man on all levels. To make the collaboration even more meaningful, as a child, I listened to Tiny Dancer in the car in Louisiana as I rode to and from my dance and gymnastics classes. Sir Elton was kind and made me feel so comfortable. Once we'd worked out a date to record the song, I headed over to the producer's home studio in Beverly Hills. The studio was in the basement of the house. I had never seen a setup like it. It was a completely open studio with guitars, pianos, soundboards, and music equipment all set out. I was nervous because it would be the first time the world had heard my singing voice on something new in 6 years. But I believed in the song and in myself, so I went for it. I stood in front of the microphone, sped up the tempo, and began to sing. After a few hours, we were done. I had recorded a duet with one of my favorite artists on one of my favorite songs. I was excited, anxious, and emotional in the weeks leading up to the release. Before the conservatorship, I would go on stage and everyone would look to me for the signal that it was time to start the show. I'd hold up my index finger and say, "Let's go." Under the conservatorship, I always had to wait for everyone else. I was told, "We'll let you know when we're ready." I didn't feel like they treated me as if I had any value. I hated it. I'd been taught through the conservatorship to feel almost too fragile, too scared. That's the price I paid under the conservatorship. They took a lot of my womanhood, my sword, my core, my voice, the ability to say fuck you. And I know that sounds bad, but there is something crucial about this. Don't underestimate your power. Hold Me Closer debuted on August 26, 2022. By August 27, we were number one in 40 countries. My first number one and my longest charting single in almost 10 years. And on my own terms, fully in control. Fans said that on the track I sounded amazing. Sharing your work with the world is terrifying, but in my experience, it is always worthwhile. Recording Hold Me Closer and putting it out into the world was a fantastic experience. It didn't feel good. It felt great. Pushing forward in my music career is not my focus at the moment. Right now, it's time for me to try to get my spiritual life in order, to pay attention to the little things, to slow down. It's time for me not to be someone who other people want. It's time to actually find myself. As I've gotten older, I like my time alone. Being an entertainer was great, but over the last 5 years, my passion to entertain in front of a live audience has lessened. I do it for myself now. I feel God more when I'm alone. I'm no saint, but I do know God. I have a lot of soul searching to do. It's going to be a process. I'm already enjoying it. Change is good. Hissam and I always pray together. I look up to him. His consistency with working out and being a good man and being healthy and taking care of me and helping me learn how we can take care of each other. He's such an inspiration and I'm grateful. The timing of the end of the conservatorship was perfect for our relationship. We were able to establish a new life together without limitations and get married. Our wedding was a beautiful celebration of how much we'd been through together and how deeply we wished for each other's happiness. The day the conservatorship ended, I was left with so many emotions. Shock, relief, elation, sadness, joy. I felt betrayed by my father and, sadly, by the rest of my family, too. My sister and I should have found comfort in each other, but unfortunately that hasn't been the case. As I was fighting the conservatorship and receiving a lot of press attention, she was writing a book capitalizing on it. She rushed out salacious stories about me, many of them hurtful and outrageous. I was really let down. Shouldn't sisters be able to confess their fear or vulnerability to each other without that later being used as evidence of instability? I couldn't help but feel that she wasn't aware of what I'd been through. It appeared that she thought it had been easy for me because so much fame had come to me so young, and that she blamed me for my success and everything that came with it. Jamie Lynn clearly suffered in our family home, too. She grew up a child of divorce, which I did not. It seems that she didn't get a lot of parenting, and I know it was hard to try and sing and act and make her own way in the world in the shadow of a sibling who got not only most of the family's attention, but a lot of the world's. My heart goes out to her for all those reasons. But I don't think she fully understands just how desperately poor we were before she was born. Because of the money I brought to the family, she wasn't helpless in the face of our father, like my mother and I were back in the 1980s. When you have nothing, that pain gets intensified by your inability to escape. My mom and I had to witness the ugliness and the violence without believing there was anywhere else to go. She will always be my sister, and I love her and her beautiful family. I wish the absolute best for them. She's been through a lot, including teen pregnancy, divorce, and her daughter's near-fatal accident. She's spoken about the pain of growing up in my shadow. I'm working to feel more compassion than anger toward her and toward everyone who I feel has wronged me. It's not easy. I've had dreams in which June tells me he knows he hurt my father, who then hurt me. I felt his love and that he'd changed on the other side. I hope that one day I will be able to feel better about the rest of my family, too. My anger has been manifesting itself physically, especially with migraine headaches. When I get them, I don't want to go to the doctor because being sent to one doctor after another all those years gave me a phobia about them. And so I take care of things myself. When it comes to the migraines, I don't like to talk about them because I'm superstitious that if I do, they'll bother me more. When I have one, I can't go into the light and I can't move. I stay very still in the dark. Any light makes my head throb and makes me feel like I'm going to pass out. It's that painful. I have to sleep for a day and a half. Until recently, I'd never had a headache in my whole life. My brother used to complain about his headaches, and I thought he was exaggerating how bad they were. Now I'm sorry I ever said anything to doubt him. For me, a migraine is worse than a stomach virus. At least with a bug, you can still think straight. Your head can help you figure out what you want to do, what movies you want to watch. But when you have a migraine, you can't do anything because your brain is gone. Migraines are just one part of the physical and emotional damage I have now that I'm out of the conservatorship. I don't think my family understands the real damage that they did. For 13 years, I wasn't allowed to eat what I wanted, to drive, to spend my money how I wanted, to drink alcohol or even coffee. Freedom to do what I want to do has given me back my womanhood. In my 40s, I'm trying things for what feels like the first time. I feel like the woman in me was pushed down for so long. Now, finally, I'm roaring back to life. I might actually be able to go sin in Sin City, too. Chapter 49. I've started to experience the riches of being an adult woman for the first time in many years. I feel like I've been underwater for so long, only rarely swimming up to the surface to gasp for air and a little food. When I regained my freedom, that was my cue to step out onto dry land, and at any time I want, to take vacations, sip a cocktail, drive my car, go to a resort, or stare out at the ocean. I've been taking it a day at a time and trying to be thankful for the little things. I'm thankful that my father is not in my life. I don't have to be scared of him anymore. If I gain weight, it's a relief to know that no one is going to be there shouting at me, "You need to pick it up." I get to eat chocolate again. As soon as my father was no longer around, making me eat what he wanted me to eat, my body became strong and my fire came back. I had confidence, and I started to like how I looked again. I love playing dress up on Instagram. I know that a lot of people don't understand why I love taking pictures of myself naked or in new dresses. But I think if they'd been photographed by other people thousands of times, prodded and posed for other people's approval, they'd understand that I get a lot of joy from posing the way I feel sexy and taking my own picture, doing whatever I want with it. I was born into this world naked, and I honestly feel like the weight of the world has been on my shoulders. I wanted to see myself lighter and freer. As a baby, I had my whole life in front of me, and that's how I feel now, like a blank slate. I really do feel reborn. Singing as I walk around at home just like I did as a little girl, I enjoy that feeling of the sound leaving my body and bouncing back at me. I'm finding the joy again of why I wanted to sing to begin with. That feeling is sacred for me. I do it for me and for nobody else. I keep getting asked when I'm going to put on shows again. I confess that I'm struggling with that question. I'm enjoying dancing and singing the way I used to when I was younger and not trying to do it for my family's benefit, not trying to get something, but doing it for me and for my genuine love of it. Only now do I feel like I'm getting back my trust in other people and my faith in God. I know what makes me happy and brings me joy. I try to meditate on those places and thoughts that enable me to experience it. I love beautiful places, my sons, my husband, my friends, my pets. I love my fans. When it comes to fans, people sometimes ask me about my special relationship with the gay community. For me, it's all about love, unconditional love. My gay friends were always protective of me, maybe because they knew that I was kind of innocent. Not dumb, but way too kind. And I think a lot of the gay guys around me took on a supportive role. I could even feel it on stage when they were beside me. If I thought I didn't do my best performance, I could count on my friends to realize I didn't feel great about it and still say, "You did so good." That kind of love means everything to me. Some of my favorite nights were when I would go out with my dancers. One time in Europe, we went to a gay club where I felt like everyone around me on the dance floor was so tall. The club played great electro dance music, and I loved it. I danced until 6 o'clock in the morning and felt like it went by in 2 seconds. My heart was so alive. It was like the mystical time in Arizona. It was a spiritual experience to be with people who I could feel loved me unconditionally. With friends like that, it doesn't matter what you do or say or who you know. That's true love. I remember one time in Italy, too. I went to a showcase where some drag artists were doing my songs. It was so amazing. The artists were beautiful. They were living in the moment, and I could tell they loved to perform. They had such heart and drive, and I respect that a lot. Once I was freed from the conservatorship, I got to go to the two vacation places that I'd missed, Maui and Cancun. I swam in the ocean, sat out in the sun, played with my new puppy, Sawyer, and took boat rides with Hisam. I read a lot, and I wrote this book. While I was traveling, I found out that I was pregnant. I'd wanted another baby for so many years. For a long time, Hisam and I had been eager to start our own family. I have an appreciation for how stable he is. I love that he doesn't even drink. He's a gift from God. And to find out he and I were about to have a child together made me feel giddy. I was also scared. When I was pregnant with Sean Preston and Jaden, I suffered from depression. Pregnancy this time felt the same in a lot of ways. I felt a little sick and loved food and sex, and so I wondered if the depression would return too. I did feel a little bit slower. I like to be up and with it. But my life was so much better, and I had so much support that I felt confident I could make it through. Before the end of my first trimester, I miscarried. I'd been so thrilled to be pregnant that I'd told the whole world, which meant I had to untell them. We posted on Instagram, "It is with our deepest sadness we have to announce that we have lost our miracle baby early in the pregnancy. This is a devastating time for any parent. Perhaps we should have waited to announce until we were further along. However, we were overly excited to share the good news. Our love for each other is our strength. We will continue trying to expand our beautiful family. We are grateful for all of your support. We kindly ask for privacy during this difficult moment." I was devastated to have lost the baby. Once again, though, I used music to help me gain insight and perspective. Every song I sing or dance to lets me tell a different story and gives me a new way to escape. Listening to music on my phone helps me cope with the anger and sadness I face as an adult. I try not to think too much about my family these days, but I do wonder what they will think of this book. Because I was silenced for 13 years, I wonder if, when they see me speaking out, they've had the occasional thought, maybe she's right. I believe they have a guilty conscience, that they know deep down that it was very, very wrong to do to me what they did. From all those years, making myself do what I was told and being treated in a certain way, I've come to see what kind of people I want to be around and what kind of people I don't. So much of the media was cruel to me, and that hasn't changed just because I am out of the conservatorship. There's been a lot of speculation about how I'm doing. I know my fans care. I am free now. I'm just being myself and trying to heal. I finally get to do what I want when I want, and I don't take a minute of it for granted. Freedom means being goofy, silly, and having fun on social media. Freedom means taking a break from Instagram without people calling 911. Freedom means being able to make mistakes and learning from them. Freedom means I don't have to perform for anyone, on stage or off stage. Freedom means that I get to be as beautifully imperfect as everyone else. And freedom means the ability and the right to search for joy in my own way, on my own terms. It took a long time and a lot of work for me to feel ready to tell my story. I hope it inspires people on some level and can touch hearts. Since I've been free, I've had to construct a whole different identity. I've had to say, wait a second, this is who I was, someone passive and pleasing, a girl. And this is who I am now, someone strong and confident, a woman. When I was a little girl lying on the warm rocks in my neighbor's garden, I had big dreams. I felt calm and in control. I knew I could make my dreams come true. For so long, I didn't always have the power to make the world look the way I wanted it to, but in many ways I do now. I can't change the past, but I don't have to be lonely or scared anymore. I've been through so much since I wandered the Louisiana woods as a child. I've made music, traveled all over the world, become a mother, found love and lost it, and found it again. It's been a while since I felt truly present in my own life, in my own power, in my womanhood. But I'm here now.
The Woman in Me was written by Brittany Spears and read by Michelle Williams, with an introduction read by the author. The recording engineer was Rich Cutler at Blue Table Post in Brooklyn, New York. Brittany Spears was recorded on location by Cade Hudson. Editing, mix, and post-production by Travis Tunn of Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Hanu Matsudaira. Special thanks to Lauren Spiegel, Caroline Pallotta, and Louisa Solomon. The Woman in Me was produced by Elisa Shokoff and directed by Thomas Kael. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Woman in Me is available in print from Gallery Books.